All right, good evening, everybody. Welcome to another Bristol Confringe. And this month we have an open mic session, which means I haven't got a clue who's actually going to read, and I'm going to be relying on somebody else to tell me. I'm also apparently relying on Heather with the ticking strawberry of doom to keep everybody to their allotted 5 minutes. I'm not sure as how many people we've got, so possibly after everybody's had a turn, we might bring one or two people back if they got cut off in the middle of something dramatic. But other than that, it's 5 minutes for everybody. So, who is going to be the first victim?
The horrible thing
in the room is just arrived. Oh, the nachos. Joe's nachos are going to be the first victim, yes. Whoa, sorry about that.
John will eat all my nachos.
Right, so Jo can't eat first because she has to protect her nachos from the ravening horde. Does anybody else want to volunteer to read? Come on, Pete.
Come on.
What a hero. Our first reader is Mr. Pete Sutton.
Hello. I'm going to attempt to read 5 stories in 5 minutes, and I'm going to fail. But the last one's the longest one, so if I end in a cliffhanger, you might want to call me back or not. Up to you. Okay, so, ready. Number one, overdue book. I checked the Necronomicon out of the library, and now I can't find it, and it's overdue. Perhaps it's been eaten by some cyclopean, rugose, squamous, tentacular horror. Perhaps somebody else picked it up. Elsie from my mum's book club did go mad last week after all. Mind you, she wasn't all there to begin with. I'll have to go in and explain. I'm worried about the fine. Those librarians are really scary, and there is that unspeakably shaped, funny coloured stain on the library floor. Perhaps I'll just check my non-Euclidean bedroom one last time. Number two, the werewolves are hairy. So why am I in detention? They say that Mr. Rimmer is a werewolf. It's because he's really hairy. He's got a great big bushy beard. He even has hair coming out of his ears and the neck of his shirt. And he growls when teaching us football. Stephen King said the werewolves are hairy on the inside. I tried to imagine what that's like. Weren't the Furby all manky with blood, snot, brains and stuff? I had a hair stuck in my throat once. Couldn't swallow without feeling it. Perhaps that's what being a werewolf is like. Anyway, I tried to see inside his mouth when he was talking. He asked me what I was doing, and it's wrong not to tell the truth, isn't it? That's why I'm in detention. Number three, Rumbled. I'm hanging off the idol's head, elbow deep in one eye socket, prying the stone from the other. The second perfectly polished, stunningly expensive, massive, precious stone. A fortune. There's a creak, a stone against stone noise, then a pop. It's in the bag faster than you can say, ancient jinx. That's when the earthquake strikes. Curses. The floor underneath the idol bucks like somebody flapping a carpet. I jump clear at the toppling megalithic man just in time. Safe. There's a deep, throaty grinding noise and shouting. Cultists. Rumbled and caught. It's the pop for me. Number four, zoophilia. A giant clam killed my brother in Western Supermare. My uncle started something with 3 gorillas. It didn't end well. My cousin at Bristol Zoo? Well, the less said about him, the better. Perhaps I wasn't the best person to volunteer to look after the giant squid. But he looked so lonesome and adorable. I fell in love right away. I'm a sucker for tentacles. And five, this is the longest one, the memory of light. The all clear sounded at 0709. A little later, Hikari heard another airplane, another American. He shaded his eyes and looked at the sky. Everything changed in a flash. Destroyed by the light and seconds later smeared and scattered by the demon wind. At 0815, the Enola Gay dropped a little boy bomb, which created a blast equivalent to 16 kilotons of TNT. The radius of total destruction was 1 mile. 70 to 80,000 inhabitants of the city were destroyed by the blast and the resulting firestorm. The wind is a demon clawing at the hard carapace of the lighthouse. The waves are a giant's hand slapping at the rocks, making them moan as if in pain. Johnson's just checked the light and is making a brew, safe in the knowledge that the ship sailing past will avoid the rocks. There's a sudden lull, a change in the wind direction, an inhalation before the wind howls murderously once again. In a sudden silence, he hears it. When the wind takes up its ululations once more, it leaves him unsure if he'd imagined it. Impossibly, there's somebody in the light room. He goes to investigate. The man, shivering in the light, is naked and horribly disfigured with scars, like ropey purple tentacles beneath his yellow skin. His all-white eyes have epicanthal folds. He is standing still in the centre of the room, the light infusing him with an unearthly glow. He turns his cold white eyes upon Johnson, who violently shudders. The light passes on its endless blink, 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 and the man winks out of existence, 1 second there, the next gone. When the light returns, so does the man, and Johnson finally screams. I stand in the Hiroshima Peace Museum, stare at the model of the city, and try to imagine the blast. I hope when the bombs fall, I am like the people who were instantly vaporized. I wonder what happened to them. Would the light take their essence and spread it across the world? And like a dead star, would it be visible in the past? Thank you.
Congratulations, Pete. You managed to avoid getting zinged. And that's quite an achievement, 5 stories in 1 minute. We are, of course, all suckers for tentacles here. Now, do we have another volunteer? Somebody else want to read? Ian, I saw you sneak in at the back. Have you got anything for us?
No.
Joe is still eating. Dan?
Yeah, I wasn't going to read quite this early.
No one wants to read this.
That's very brave of you, Dan.
Okay, Pete did 5 stories in 5 minutes. I'm going to do about a fifth of a story in 5 minutes. The guy behind the counter looks like Harry Dean Stanton after a rough night. All crumpled face, thick messy hair and dirty white apron. He doesn't look up from the grill when I enter the diner, just nods at a stool at the counter. The cushion had been red leather once, but now it's mostly faded silver duct tape over rips, knife cuts and God knows what else. I climb up on it anyway, taking the chance to surreptitiously check out my fellow patrons. The lighting gives a few of them still there at this hour of the night, no, the morning, a pale and washed out look, like they've been painted by someone who's heard about flesh tones but doesn't quite get it. None of them were talking to, or even sat near, anyone else. I briefly wonder what path someone's life leads them on for them to be sitting alone in a trashy diner at 3 in the morning, stirring bad coffee and staring out the window at the night, and quickly give it up as an impossible task. After all, I still don't quite know how I've ended up here myself. At any rate, none of them look like cops or spooks, and once I'm happy with that, my interest in them ends. I keep the silver case on the counter in front of me. I'm not going to let it out of my sight, not after what I've been through to get it. Harry Dean shuffles over to take my order. I ask for strong coffee, something to fuel my thoughts while I wait for a ride and plan my next move. I try to keep my face down, but he sees it anyway. Fell asleep on your sunbed, huh? What? Your face, man, it's all red down one side, like you fell asleep under the lamps, you know? Hey, you ever see that movie? The one with the guy sees a UFO and it burns him, and his wife is all, we've got to tell the neighbours you fell asleep on the sunbed? Damn. Last thing I need is to draw attention to myself. This is beginning to look like a mistake. No, man, no sunbed. Listen, forget that coffee, okay? I've got to get moving. I get up and grab the case, but he keeps talking. You're military, aren't you? I was in the forces myself, can always tell one. You work at that airbase down the road? Man, we see all kinds of weird stuff from that place. Lights in the sky at night, you name it. Bet you can't tell me anything about it, though. Or if you did, you'd have to kill me, huh? The swing doors cut him off. I'm alone on the side of the road, my options rapidly running out, and the silver case in my hand getting warmer by the minute. That's not just fanciful talk, not just me being all coy about it being stolen. It really is getting hot, and I don't know why, but I'm having a hard time thinking it's for any reason that might be good. And are those sirens I can hear in the distance? Okay, probably not, but it's a good indication of how twitchy I'm getting. Shouldn't she have been here by now? I can just about see a faint lightening in the sky to the east, the sun struggling to compete with the glow from the base. Where is she? I'm going to have to go. I can't afford to be caught standing around here so close to the scene of the crime. Greyhound, I think. I'm about to head back into the diner and ask old Harry Dean where the bus station is, suspecting that the Banzer will be in the next town over, or the one over from that, when I finally hear an engine. I can't see any car yet and I tense up, half expecting Jane, half expecting a Humvee with angry military policemen piling out of it. The hollow pit in my stomach gets deeper as the engine gets louder, but when it comes into the square, it's a shabby red Mustang with a young woman behind the wheel. My sister, thank God. She pulls up and I sprint over and jump in. Richard, are we on the run? Awesome, we're going to be just like Bonnie and Clyde. Yeah, I think. And look how that particular story turned out. Just drive, Jane. We've got to get out of here as soon as we can. She guns the engine and we hightail it out of town. No sirens yet. Maybe we'll be okay. Maybe. So, she says, what's going on? What's so important that I get a phone call at 3 a.m. and I have to pick you up right away from some dive? Shit, phone, I think, and fumble my cell phone out of my pocket. Yep, still on, happily broadcasting our location to anyone who's listening. I pull out the SIM and snap it between my fingers. I take the battery out as well, and for good measure I chuck the poor little suddenly deaf-mute thing out the window to get crushed under some trucker's rig. That's one avenue of pursuit closed down, but now I'm worried about how many more I might have left even without even knowing it. Long story, I say. Tell you later. Just drive for now. Ever obedient, she pulls out of the square and heads off out of town, past the electric lights and into the night. I'm too tired to talk, but I look at her as she drives and I think about all the other scrapes she has helped me out of, the time she lied to her parents to take some of the heat off me. For the first time, I get a twinge of doubt. Maybe I shouldn't have got her involved in this. This is too big. Way bigger than lying about exactly who broke Mrs. Bennett's window, or that time I got her to pose as an aggrieved girlfriend to help me bail out of a bad day. She doesn't deserve this. Okay, I say, this is what's going on. I've got something here, something I shouldn't have, and something that a lot of people are going to want back very quickly. We need to get as far from here as we can and figure out what to do next. Is it to do with your work, she asks. I nod. Then I don't want to know, she says. The less I know, less trouble I'm in, right? Maybe, I say, not really believing it myself. An hour later, we're racing the dawn across the desert, and I'm getting increasingly freaked out about the way this case is getting hotter. Jane, we're going to have to stop soon, I say. Ah, oh, what about the feds? You promised me feds, she mock pouts. But to be honest, the humour is wasted on me now. I've been awake for nearly 26 hours, and I don't think I'm getting some sleep anytime soon. I just grunt and point at the tarmac, wondering what the hell to do with a Sansomite briefcase that feels like it could catch fire at any minute. I promise, it does get a bit science fiction later.
Ros is sneaking out to go and look after her new puppy, which is, and it's not a sad puppy, it's a very happy puppy. People on the podcast will understand what that means, even if people here don't. Okay, do we have any other volunteers to read? Anybody keen and eager to leap forward? All right, so next up is going to be Joanne Hall.
Okay, so I'm going to read the beginning of a short story which is currently on submission with the Chris Link's Fight Like a Girl anthology, but has not yet been accepted. So this might be the only time anybody hears it ever. And it's called Arrested Development, and it's way too long for this, but I will start. So Heather, are we ready? Kay's back slammed into the canvas and bounced once, twice, before coming to rest. The air burst from her lungs, sending up a fine spray of blood from her nostrils. The blurred face of the referee loomed over her. He raised his eyebrows in question or concern, his hand already beating out the countdown. She allowed herself 7 seconds. 7 blissful seconds where she could have been lying on the softest bed in the most palatial grand house before she forced herself up onto her elbows, shaking her head. The murmur of exchanged bets intensified. The referee stepped back. He wasn't permitted to help her to her feet. She had to stand on her own. It was one of the few rules. Kay's opponent had retreated to the corner and was glaring at her, yellow eyes beetling beneath her lowered brow shield. The wire mesh of the cage threw patterned shadows across her green skin. One of her incisors was loose and bloody, and she wobbled it with forked tongue as she stared. Kay didn't know her name. The Grands didn't share their names with humans, and it didn't matter to Kay anyway. She was just another fight. Are you ready? The referee asked. Kay wiped the blood from her nose and her eyebrow with the back of her bandaged hand and bounced on the balls of her feet. Bring it on, she said thickly. The lithe Grand flicked her loose tooth with her tongue in a final gesture of contempt and rose to her feet. Her spine cracked, audible even over the rustles of the crowd. Grand in the front rows, humans pushed to the back and the sides. At full stretch, she was a head taller than Kay, and her tail lashed back and forth as she prowled, waiting for the signal. At the whistle, the Grand lunged forward. Kay bounced back, leaping high over that lashing tail that thickened to a club at the tip. She had seen other fighters go down with broken ribs or legs after a blow from a Grand tail. Kay had toyed with the idea of getting the enhancement. It was better for balance, an extra weapon. But it would cost every credit she had and more, and she needed to save her cash. There was a trade. There was always a trade. She could add the enhancement, fight better now, and make more money in the short term. Or she could do what she had been doing for the better part of a decade and invest in the future, a better future, and not just for her. The Grand stumbled, momentarily thrown by the force of the blow that didn't connect. Kay was on her in an instant, raining punches against the hard carapace of her barrel chest. The Grand pushed at her with stout arms, seeking an opening. She jabbed in hard against Kay's ribcage, a series of sharp explosions that left her reeling and drooling. The crowd roared, or that could just be the blood rushing in her ears. Her foot slipped on the canvas and she lurched forward. Recovering from the slip, she caught the Grand around the waist, barreling into her and pushing her back against the wire of the cage. The Grand's feet scraped against the canvas as she tried to lift one leg to claw Kay's stomach. Talons raked her bare thigh, scoring twin lines of fire from groin to knee. Kay pressed harder, breathing in her opponent's sweat, her musty lizard scent. Fingers on her left hand dug into the flesh of the Grun's back, slick there with loose scales as she shed in fear. Kay was inside her grip now, pressed tight as a lover, shifting so her elbow ground against the Grun's exposed throat. She pushed the Grun back, yellow eyes bulging, feet skittering for purchase as the metal of the cage dug into the flesh of Kay's wrist. Kay clenched her teeth and hung on, muscles burning from the strain. The Grun made a choking sound. Drool hung in strings from her lipless mouth, and her eyes popped red as thousands of tiny blood vessels burst. Kay pushed harder, crushing her windpipe, willing her to break. The female Grun was as tense as wire, and then all at once Kay felt her snap, muscles falling into slackness. She stepped back and the Grun slumped forward, like a tree toppling. Kay slammed a fist into the back of her head as she went down, just to make sure. She held her breath for the long 10 seconds it took the referee to count the Grun out, exhaling only as he took her arm and raised it high above her head. The Grun in the pricey seats hissed and flicked their tongues. The humans in the cheap seats cheered. Money changed hands, and Kay accepted the applause. She felt no particular joy, only satisfaction that another job survived without serious injury, another day lived through. Still lucky, she breathed. By the time the referee released her, the defeated Grun had crawled away, back to her own team and the nurture of her people. Kay had no people in the arena. She didn't need them. She was used to acting alone. By the time she lowered herself out of the cage, wincing as the adrenaline wore off and the pain kicked in, the hall was almost empty. The punters had paid their entrance fee, placed their bets and won or lost, and now they were streaming out into the afternoon, back to their Grun house or to their own towns. Not to the Delphi. No one who lived in the Delphi could afford to watch fights.
Hey, thank you, Joe. We should have one more reader before we have a break, I think.
Hi, I'm Phil Purser-Hallard. If you were at the last open mic session, I can't remember when, but months and months ago, you might remember that I read a cinema-style trailer for my book, The Pendragon Protocol, which is the first volume in the Devices trilogy. And I've got a similar thing for the second book, The Loxley Exploit, which is out now already in ebook format and will be out in paperback in June. If you were there, you may even recall the singing. Fortunately, that's never made it onto the internet, I don't think. Paul Parsons shakes his head angrily. What could Robin Hood's merry men possibly want with the Holy Grail? It's 2015, and Camelot and Sherwood are at war. Stephen Muckagee feels no qualms as the chapel men and women round the corner. He and Blythe have Wright on their side after all. Wright, polymer-coated steel blades, and the devices of two puissant and noble knights. You there, stop, Stephen shouts, raising his sword in challenge with all the authority the circle vests in him. Put down your weapons and surrender. The chapel's lead man has his green hood pulled over his face, revealing only a firm mouth and stubbly chin. Even so, as he raises his longbow, knocks an arrow and gives it flight, jamming it firmly into the shoulder of Blythe's armour, Stephen knows him. The Circle, the UK paramilitary agency whose knights carry the devices of the members of King Arthur's Round Table. The stuttered bellow of the guns is deafening, as is the shrieking of the office alarm, but the knights' shields and armour hold firm as they march like inexorable sci-fi robots across the open-plan office space. Through the choking cordite smoke, Jory can see Paul's emblem of three red bars, Stephen's black and white checks, Transom's elaborate sailing ship juddering with the multiple impacts. The burgundy upholstery is taking a shredding from the swords, not to mention the gunfire, and there's a computer exploding every few seconds. Is hunting, the Green Chapel, eco-activists allied to Robin Hood's Merry Men. Merry's about to sing. She's standing, her russet hair hanging about her shoulders like a copper beech's crown. She squeezes Jory's hand and he slips away quietly, but everyone's eyes are on Merry herself. Her poise admits no nervousness, no embarrassment, at bursting into a song in a packed pub where many of the drinkers are complete strangers, as she begins. The outlaw's flag is Lincoln green, the emerald of a forest scene. Beneath it rests a martyr true, enfolded in its fir tree hue. For the knights, this quest is personal as well as political. The chapel's leader, Jory Taylor, is himself an errant knight, and he has stolen the Holy Grail from the British Museum. Stop, Merry cries, jumping onto a trestle table. Nobody pays any attention, obviously, so she reaches into her denim holdall, untangles the Grail from her spare bra, and holds it up, yelling, stop, again! She leaps down and marches forward, bearing the Grail aloft. Knights of the Circle, peasants of the Green Chapel, she cries, raising her voice above the quietening melee as the combatants begin to spot what she's doing. You British beasts and you the Adam Bell gang, she continues as the realisation spreads. All of you, stop fighting. This is sacred ground. But this war is fought with modern weapons. There's a longish pause. Then Jory says, just consider it, Rev. They know about the trip. They've been surveilling you with drones. They know exactly where your HQ is, and they're coming just as soon as they've broken the back of your resistance. I never expected anything less, Cantrell says. He knows about the quadcopter camera drones. Indeed, he knows that it's only reluctance to provoke international reprisals that's kept the Circle from using larger combat UAVs on British citizens, rather than mere surveillance models. That reluctance is unlikely to last the duration. Are we done now? There's a long pause. Then Jory says, good luck, Rev, and hangs up. And nowhere, from the Circle's Thameside Fortress to a Bristol squat, from the oldest pub in England to a music festival in Cheshire, will remain untouched. The unit reasserts its formation in the approach to the festival village, delicious smells eddying dizzying past the knights as they crash along a parade of food vendors selling Arabic-style pizza, churros with hot chocolate and authentic Tibetan momos. A sight-vibing sculpture of a dancing couple is trampled in pieces under the outlier's hooves. One horse bursts without hesitating through a canvas graffiti wall. Stephen draws his sword and, with a whoop, hacks down a Jolly Roger flagpole as he passes. This is the most fun he's had since that time he got to lob some practice balls at Sachin Tendulkar. And now the horses are in the open again, in a field fringed with booths and marquees, at one end of which a sign announces the village tavern. Joyfully, Stephen directs his steed in a wide arc, keeping formation with his brother knights, and turns her head towards the whitest, widest of the giant tents, where even now a motley assemblage of men and women in hoodies of various colours, but with green predominating, are gaping in alarm and scrambling clumsily to their feet to face the charge. Before long, the enmity between its greatest heroes will tear Britain apart. So raise the verdant banner high, forever green against the sky, through winter's chill and summer's cheer, we'll keep the green flag flying here. The Devices Trilogy, Book 2, The Loxley Exploit, available now. Thank you.
Okay, that's four down, so I think it's about time we had a little break for the restroom and replenishing our glasses. We can be back in about 5 minutes. And other people who are interested in reading, please come and let me know so we can be slightly more organised in the next session.